Hello and welcome back to the Shakespeare Birthday Party. I am Danny Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Grace Fitzpatrick.
And today we are discussing the Merry Wives of Windsor, which, as we mentioned last time, was written in response to Queen Elizabeth's demand for more Falstaff. So basically it is kind of in the universe of the Henry IV plays. And essentially it involves a comic romp in which the wives, Mistress Page and Mistress Ford, trick Sir John Falstaff, who thinks he is tricking them. He, of course, is on the hunt for money, as always, to be put toward more sack and other tasty things. So basically the two deceive him, they invite him for trysts, and then variously throw him with a basket of laundry into a river, have him beaten by Master Ford, and have him dress up as a strange oak monster in the forest. So the play is a lot of fun, and we found it interesting also for a lot of the connections that it seems to suggest between this play and others of Shakespeare's plays, and then also to things like The Lord of the Rings. So we'll get to that in due time. But Grace, I don't know if you want to start us off with any of your observations.
Yeah, this play was great. I know we both really enjoyed it. I think it's very underrated, just as one of his greater comedies. I don't know, maybe I'm late to the party, but we did talk a lot about that final prank that the wives play on Falstaff, where they trick him into dressing up as like a stag-horned fertility god, basically, yeah, underneath the oaks to go a-maying, and, you know, not that just called to mind a bunch of images from Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
And so we looked it up, and it looks like Midsummer was probably written or popular around, like, 1595, 1596,
mm-hmm.
and then Merry Wives around 1603, mm-hmm. I believe it was. So given the popularity of Midsummer, these images would have been very familiar to very familiar and very beloved to an Elizabethan audience. And that's kind of what Falstaff is. You know, he's kind of like that beloved kind of Kramer, George Costanza character,
yeah,
that you just love to see bursting into the room, bursting onto the stage.
Yeah.
I don't know if you
Despite
wanted to...
their depravity.
Right, yes, exactly. Yeah, like, they're not really good people, Kramer, George Costanza, or Falstaff. They're not very good people. But for some reason, we just can't help but love them and just be delighted by them.
Yeah.
Anytime they show up. But yeah, Falstaff definitely connects really well with Bottom from Midsummer.
Yeah,
because,
for sure.
You know, he has all these pranks that the wives subject him to over the course of the play, and their express purpose for doing this is to just embarrass him.
Yeah.
And sure, their pranks succeed, but I don't think they ever really succeed in embarrassing him. Like, he's never ashamed of himself, or like sometimes he's annoyed, like when they dump him out of the laundry basket, but he's never really embarrassed. Like, you don't get the sense of him regretting any of his actions.
Yeah.
Which is just, it just kind of like snowballs through the course of the play. And Bottom is the same way, because, you know, they're each character is his own ideal. So how, what reason could he have to be embarrassed at anything?
Yeah, that makes me think also of just the importance of disguises in this play, but also in a lot of other plays, like Much Ado or The Merchant of Venice. But there's this way in which disguises, of course, help to bring out the... by covering the truth of one character, help to uncover the truth of another one.
Mm.
So, like, when Master Ford keeps appearing in disguise to Falstaff to urge him to go to Mistress Ford to help catch her in her adultery, which she is obviously not intending to commit. We get this curious, like, I don't know, this interesting forthrightness on Falstaff's part, where he's confessing himself to Ford, who is not Ford to him. And so we get all these, like, different layers of expectation within the play. I think it's worth describing in a little bit of detail just the hilarity of the first two encounters. So in the first one, Mistress Ford, knowing that her husband will be out on some errand, which he knows he will not be out on, invites Falstaff to come to her house. He does. Then Mistress Page runs in and says, "Oh, Mistress Ford, your husband is coming. Who's here with you?" And Mistress Ford tries to say no one, but then admits that it's Falstaff. So in the first instance, they hide him in this big laundry basket, throw a bunch of laundry on top of him, have two servants carry it out to the river. So they dump him in the river. He, of course, is extremely upset. Master Ford is very upset as well, because he knows that Falstaff was supposed to be there. He can't find him in the house. He's brought all of his friends to see the villainy at work, which is also a little bit similar to Much Ado, just in the exposure of Hero.
Yeah.
Which, of course, goes horribly. There's none of that sort of... The discomfiture is all on Master Ford's part in this case. So then basically the scenario is repeated. Only this time, since they've done the laundry basket bit already, they have Falstaff dress up as one of Mistress Ford's aunts, who is particularly odious to Master Ford. Who has threatened to beat this aunt severely should she ever appear on the premises again. And so that's exactly what happens to Falstaff. He's beaten mercilessly and sent on his way, but not discovered for who he is.
Yeah. I wonder if Shakespeare... I mean, he must have been aware that he was parodying himself with all of these connections that, you know, simple you and I are able to pick up on. So yeah, that's really interesting, and there is kind of a mad dance of pranks that's very, it has the same kind of feel as Much Ado. And we have just like the cleverness of Mistress Ford, who is pranking not only Falstaff but also her overprotective and kind of sour husband at the same time, just effortlessly. Yeah. And something that I found really interesting, which was also another connection to Midsummer, was that the people who are the supreme pranksters, you could say, the ones who end up tricking everyone, are Fenton and Anne Page. So we have this kind of underlying romance narrative that's kind of the thread that gets pulled throughout the entire play, where you're wondering, like, okay, well, Anne Page, she's this young woman who Mistress Page and her husband are trying to marry off, and they each want her to marry someone different, and all these other male characters want to marry her as well.
Right.
And finally, at the end of the play, we see that Fenton and Anne Page have kind of snuck off and gotten married, and then they come back. But like Midsummer, the romance of the comedy, what should be traditionally kind of the crowning jewel of and the full focus of the play, the characters themselves seem to me to be supremely uninteresting. Like, they're really just ancillary to the action of the wives and Falstaff. Another great thing about the end is that after Fenton and Anne Page have tricked everyone, you'd think, you know, Anne Page's parents might be upset mm-hmm. by this, or any of her other suitors, but there's just this, like, the, like, Falstaffian nonchalance mm-hmm. has just imbued itself so perfectly that nobody even cares. Like, everybody's, mm-hmm. there's just this sense of overwhelming, not even forgiveness or mercy, not even that much, just affability yeah. That just comes from the character of Falstaff, I would say.
Yeah.
So everybody's able to just relax and yeah. accept the outcome of the play.
Yeah. Yeah. Even Falstaff gets invited to the reception.
Exactly. Yeah. yeah. It's so strange. A funny note. Okay, so I found this. I don't even remember what it's called, but I found this super old... can I say that super old? It's from the 90s. clearly. This very 90s Shakespeare documentary series. And the people who are involved in it are super knowledgeable, but the actual organization of the thing is just... they just threw it out the window. So it's very unclear, like, what the... what the point of it is, but yeah. there's this one episode where the historian who's is just like dropping these just interesting facts about Shakespeare and Elizabethan times, and there's a whole scene where she talks about the potato and how it was relatively new or considered exotic in mm-hmm. Elizabethan times, and yeah. for some reason people in England at this time thought that the potato was an aphrodisiac, and so mm-hmm. they just thought, like, this magical, wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And, like, that was the whole point of this one scene of the documentary. so I was like, that's interesting. I'm going to see if I can, you know, spot any potatoes in Shakespeare plays
yeah.
hereafter. And sure enough, yeah. when Falstaff is decked out in his... maying garb, I would imagine, awaiting Mistress Ford and Mistress Page for, I guess, like some kind of weird menage a trois situation. he sees the ladies approach and he shouts out, like, "Let it rain, potatoes." And I read that and thought, I know what that means.
yeah.
And this is really funny. But then, of course, it gets even better when, instead of a fairy queen Titania, they have Mistress Quigley dressed up as the fairy queen.
Yeah.
And then all the little children disguised as fairies that who's a Dr. Caius has, like, instructed to pinch yeah. Falstaff yeah. unmercifully.
Yeah.
So it's just, it was wonderful and hilarious.
Yeah, that was great.
Yep. I know you also picked up on some potential Tolkien connections.
Yeah, well, so there are the two, I mean, basically two names that come up, which are, like, definitely associated with Tolkien more than anybody else, but there's this reference to the Latin Bilbo, which apparently refers to a type of sword, chiefly made in Bilbao, and but is obviously, you know, I mean, no one can hear the word Bilbo these days and not think Tolkien. Likewise, there's a reference to a man of Middle Earth, which is also, you know, plainly Tolkien.
Definitely.
There. So, obviously, Tolkien was extremely well read, and so I don't know if he got the idea for using those two names from Shakespeare, but I'm sure that in choosing them he was at least aware of their presence in
Definitely.
Shakespeare. It's hard to say why. I don't know, like, what the sort of resonance is between The Merry Wives of Windsor and The Lord of the Rings.
That is a good question.
yeah.
I mean, it's definitely a very jovial play, and you've got a lot of joviality in Tolkien storytelling. Also, this Shakespeare play, something I was thinking about with the word, where the word Bilbo comes from, Shakespeare definitely pokes a lot of fun at non-English people, like foreigners.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if that might have gone into his decision making with that, with, because he uses the word Bilbo quite a bit throughout this play. So that might be something.
Yeah.
There, I mean, Tolkien's stories definitely have reflections on the, I don't know, the foreigner and home.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of different peoples, creatures, things like that. So I bet it's, but there's something there.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's something else you wanted to add to that. I was thinking earlier about Falstaff's honor speech that is so beloved, and just how funny it is that for the character that makes fun of seeking honor, that he's possibly the most popular Shakespeare character, the most remembered character. So you could say, you know, it kind of makes you wonder about what Shakespeare's intent was with Falstaff. Mm-hmm. Like, did he think he was just writing kind of a funny Kramerish character? Yeah. Or was he almost using, like, reverse psychology to make sure that his character Falstaff would be remembered?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. yeah, I think another thing that's very interesting with this play, especially in light of its having been written more or less at the insistence of the queen, is just the fact that the women are very clearly in charge, more or less, which is, like, it's done, Shakespeare handles it in a very, like, comic way here, obviously, but it's very consistent with, like, Wodehouse, which I know we commented a lot on how this felt very very much like a Jeeves and Wooster episode. Mm-hmm. Like, you can definitely see, like, a character getting carried out of a house in a laundry basket. Like, you definitely see that happening to Birdie or something like that. But of course, like, it's the ants who are the powerful people in the world of Wodehouse. But it's also, like, in a much more serious way present, like, especially in Faulkner. Like, it's the women who are like the sufferers and also the seats of wisdom in families.
Yeah, this is a really interesting point, because you can play that very differently, kind of having, like, a sinister puppet master feel to it, or just, I don't know, cleverness, I guess. It is also funny, too, that, like, you're right, like, Mistress Ford and Mistress Page, just a cut above the rest, like, effortlessly deceive everyone they wish to deceive, and have a wonderful time doing it. But then you also have somebody like Mistress Quickly, who tries to replicate that, but she doesn't really have any control over the other characters. Yeah. She more just tries to buddy up, like, cozy up to the different male characters and say, like, oh, yes, I'll, don't worry, I'll help you marry Anne Page.
Right.
And I'll help you marry Anne Page, and I'll help you marry Anne Page. Like, she's more just trying to, like, she makes that connection, and I don't know if she's deceiving herself in thinking that she's in charge of things.
Yeah.
Or what exactly her motive is there. Right. I don't know. She's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a great character. Yeah. Yeah, kind of a good counterpoint to Falstaff as well.
I agree. So. Yeah, and she's similar to Falstaff too. I like that. Because she doesn't change either.
Yeah.
She seems fairly, I mean, she seems fairly dissolute as well.
Yeah.
But she's also, I find her very likable.
Yeah.
Or at least very entertaining.
Yeah.
And she kind of just stays the course. Doesn't try to change or allow herself to be changed.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else come to mind for you?
I thought the scene where there were all the Latin puns was really funny. And it felt like there was a lot of, like, Lanyap type stuff, just, like, funny stuff. Like, you could tell Shakespeare had a really good time writing this play.
Yeah, for sure.
And if it is true that he was writing this kind of under pressure, then just props to William Shakespeare, for sure, because there were a couple of really quick little scenes that you could tell. Like, this was very, very quickly jotted down. Yeah. But just when you look at the whole, it's just such an intricate web of, like, all the pranks and and the whole, like, Anne Page side story, too. It's just, it's incredible to see how that, the whole story comes together.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, he's very strong.
He's a good writer.
Yes.
That Will Shakespeare.
Yes. Quite so.
What shall we read next?
Yeah, next time we are going to have a little change of pace and head over to Egypt and spend some time with Antony and Cleopatra.
Excellent.
So.
Not as happy. Not as happy a time.
Nope.
That's okay.
Lots of partying. So that's good. But, yeah, not very pleasant in the end. Different kind of powerful women.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. We'll have to see if there are any Mistress Quickleys.
Yeah. Let's hope. Alrighty. Well, until next time, party on.